Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down,
Horses. Stick in your eyes.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean...
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
G'day, I'm Mark Kenny, and this is Democracy Sausage, as you know, of course, because you've logged into it from the ANU, or Australian National University, if you prefer the full name. And because we're talking about Ukraine and Russia, as well as the fact that he's always worth listening to on a variety of subjects, we're speaking with the Defence and Strategic Policy Specialist, Dr. Charles Miller, who's been on the podcast before. He's, of course, from the School of Politics and International Relations here at ANU. Welcome back, Charlie.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Mark. Thank you for the kind words and the introduction, and thanks for having me back on.
Look, it's always a pleasure. But, of course, what we're talking about today is, I guess, doesn't really fall into the category of pleasure. It's a very disturbing situation. I mean, talking about war never is pleasant, of course, because war is the breakdown of order and the outbreak of violence. And we're seeing that, have been seeing that now for a great many months since, I think it was February 24 this year when the Russian tanks rolled across the border. And we've been dealing with the fact that, you know, a putative superpower, still a nuclear superpower, has used its might to roll into a neighbouring country and all of the issues that that has presented. And, of course, it's been a very dramatic last few weeks with the huge gains made by Ukraine, which really surprised a lot of people. I assume they surprised you as well, if not the fact that gains were being made, but the sort of scale and speed with which territory was recovered.
Yeah, I mean, it did surprise me to some degree. So first of all, it surprised me where the offensive occurred. So when I was on your show last, I said that most likely the Ukrainian offensive would occur in Kherson, but that we couldn't be sure of that, and that the Ukrainians it was in the interest of the Ukrainians to leave us kind of in the dark as to where the offensive would come, because that way they would be leaving the Russians in the dark too.
Yeah,
and that's
which is generally
what you want to do. Yeah, exactly. And so the fact that it came in the north near Kharkiv was actually that was a bit of a surprise.
And there've been gains sort of right down that kind of northeastern sort of frontier between previously Russian-held territory and Ukrainian territory. They've made incursions quite along a good deal.
They have.
Of Ukraine.
What also makes it a little bit surprising in terms of the speed is the fact that it was still, I think, a major unknown about the Ukrainian military as to whether they could conduct offensive operations as effectively as they could conduct defensive operations. So we saw with the Battle of Kyiv that they were very, very strong in the defense. You know, they could use anti-tank guided missiles and so on to frustrate the Russians and stop them taking the capital. But offensive operations are a lot more difficult generally than defensive operations.
And why is that? Is that because it involves sort of direct combat, is it, as distinct from using HIMARS to take out, you know, depots and positions behind the lines?
Well, I mean, first of all, there's a natural advantage, I think, for the defense in most types of warfare because, you know, at the simplest, most basic level, defense is about staying where you are and stopping the enemy from getting there or expelling
the enemy. So you're dug
right,
in.
Effectively. So you can take advantage of cover and so forth in ways that you can't to the same degree when you're attacking.
When you're on the run, you're
exposing yourself. You're trying to limit the extent of your exposure, but you're trying to, but you have to at some point expose yourself to enemy fire in the way that you don't necessarily have to do when you're on the defensive. So generally, the offensive is considered to be a more difficult type of warfare than defensive warfare. Also, I mean, to be successful under modern conditions, you have to be able to get all types of arms to work together. So by that, I mean, I think I've mentioned this before, but tanks, infantry, artillery, air power, and so on. If you have air power to call on, you have to be able to get them to work together as a team in order to be able to attack effectively. It's very difficult for a lot of armies to do this. It was an open question over whether the Ukrainians could do it or not, partly because they had suffered heavy losses in the original defensive fighting as well. And so a lot of their...
The Ukrainians.
The Ukrainian army, yeah. They had suffered a lot of losses of presumably their best trained, most experienced troops. And a lot of the troops they'll be putting in now will be less experienced than the ones that they lost in the early stages of the fighting. So it was really heartening for all of those, all of us who support Ukraine, that they seem to have been able to pull off a really effective offensive against the Russians and taken back a lot of territory. And of course, liberated the people in those areas from the terrible things that the Russians were doing to them. So it was a surprise, both in terms of how effective it was and also where it was too.
And just staying with this for a moment, the other surprise was, and perhaps this is in a sense the key to how quickly some of that territory was regained, was that a lot of Russian troops just abandoned their posts and abandoned their equipment and ran for the hills kind of thing.
Which
speaks to a, you know, deeper problem that Russia has in this whole conflict.
I should point out that a lot of the troops that the Ukrainians were facing in the offensive around Kharkiv were not regular Russian army. They were from two sources, one of them being the Rosgvardia, which is the Russian Guard is what it's called. They're basically a paramilitary riot police. So they are thugs whose job is to beat up protesters and protect Putin's regime. They're not really trained and equipped to face regular soldiers. The other source was what's called the military of the LNR. So the LNR is the name for the Russian puppet republic in eastern Ukraine, one of the Russian puppet republics in eastern Ukraine. So these are basically Ukrainians who are conscripted by the pro-Russian authorities in their local area to fight against fellow Ukrainians. And obviously, neither of these two forces were particularly well trained or particularly well motivated, and so they folded quite quickly. Having said that, I've been hearing a lot of things about the training and the motivation of the regular Russian army, even some of the elite Russian units, which suggest that they may not be very much better, to be honest.
Yeah, so we expected when these gains were made that, I mean, sort of, I guess, you know, normal, ordinary lay opinion would imagine this, that there would be some sort of response, that Putin's not going to take that kind of international humiliation or even domestic potential embarrassment lying down. And we've seen some responses now in two principal forms. We've seen the call for effectively the draft of somewhere between 300,000 and some say as high as 1.2 million able-bodied reservists, although some of them, it turns out,
not
are not
quite
able-bodied. Because it looks like it's all been sort of botched and rushed. And, of course, the other side of it is we've seen, there's no other way of putting it, nuclear saber-rattling by Putin, saying to the world, well, don't push me. I'm not bluffing. And this is a massively nuclear-armed state. So there's some pretty worrying responses.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let me talk about the mobilization first of all.
Yeah.
So the mobilization, what called originally for 300,000 troops, but there are suggestions that they're actually mobilizing more people. It does seem to have been very incompetently carried out. So Russian local administrators have basically got anybody that they can get and just shoved them into a recruiting office. A lot of them, like you say, are old.
The premise was that they were meant to be trained.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
that is people who are already veterans. Sort of been trained in military ways.
People who were veterans of the Russian military were now back to civilian life.
Right? Yeah.
So that's, that proved to be a little bit of a, I don't want to say misnomer, but that was rather misleading, let's put it that way. And because they have gone for a lot of people who are not fit for service, very old. They've also gone for, disproportionately it appears, non-Russian or non-Slavic minorities. So Chechens, Dagestanis, Buryats, Kalmyks, Tartars, and so on, who have already borne a disproportionate share of the burden for Russia, who are looked down on by Russian nationalists. And so you would imagine that, you know, any intrinsic motivation that they have to fight is pretty low. In fact, they may have a stronger intrinsic motivation to fight against the draft than they do to fight against the Ukrainians.
Let's
hope so, right? So this is a problem. And we've also seen large flows of Russian men of military age trying to get the hell out of Russia.
Rushing for the exits.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that flights from Moscow to Hong Kong or Johannesburg, which is two of the few places you can still fly to directly from Moscow, were selling for as much as $42,000. So that gives you some kind of an idea of how desperate many Russian men are to get out.
Can I just stop on that for a sec? It surprised me when I started seeing those stories, because I thought, presumably, once there is that draft, that mobilization, it's illegal for them to leave. But is it not? I mean, it seemed like there was a gap there.
It is now. It wasn't for a couple of days. Now, why did they do that? I don't know. I wouldn't write off administrative incompetence. I wouldn't write off the possibility that they just didn't. An ongoing theme of Russian administration here. But there's also a possibility. And in fact, this is something which I've seen some experts talk about, which is that actually it probably is in the interest, as long as the outflow isn't too big, it's probably in the interests of Putin and the Russian army for people who really, really don't want to serve to get the hell out of the country on two grounds. So first of all, that means that there are fewer people left in Russia to protest against his regime and potentially overthrow it. And secondly, that means that you're not getting a bunch of people going into the army who don't want to be there and who may undermine morale, who may serve as a kind of a fulcrum for desertions or mutinies or other kind of infractions of military discipline. So that's a more kind of sort of cunning explanation for why they didn't do that.
That sounds like a silk purse to me.
It does sound like it's probably not, you know.
Because, I mean, one would have thought the morale effect of, you know, vast numbers of people, you know, deserting at that critical moment,
right,
you know, is pretty sort of depressing for those people who weren't able to leave and who do get drafted.
I mean,
they'd be thinking, what are we, you know, mugs, soldiers, you know, when other people have had the wherewithal to leave. You know?
Where that kind of comes into play, though, I think, is in the policies of European states as to whether they would accept Russian draft evaders as refugees. So a lot of countries have said, no, we're not going to do it. You need to stay in Russia. You need to fight your regime. So Estonia being an obvious example of this. And that actually, I think that although it's kind of heartless, I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for young Russian men who don't want to go and fight in Ukraine. I mean, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to do that in their situation. But nonetheless, you want to look at it as, you know, Russia is a kind of a pressure cooker right now. And you want to keep the pressure on. You don't want to give any outlets or pressure valves for the pressure to escape. That's the way that I would think about it. So I actually do think that it is pretty much right for Russia's European neighbors to say, nope, sorry, you got to stay and fight your regime.
Yeah, well, I mean, I must say, it's also surprised me in that vein. This is not strictly about the mobilization, but the fact that wealthy Russians have been able to travel, you know, for most of the time this war's been going on, they've been able to still go to other countries and you know, be tourists and so forth. One of the reasons that sanctions are often argued against in various situations around the world is that they, you know, they hit the population more than they hit the government, and sometimes they can disproportionately hit the people who are already suffering most. And, you know, this is one of the arguments people even tried to run in the sort of Glen Eagles South African situation many years ago, that this was doing harm to the ordinary people, even though the ordinary people were desperate for the sanctions. But it strikes me that stopping wealthy Russians leaving to go and, you know, lie around swimming pools in hotels of Europe and Asia and the Caribbean might have been a good way of getting a message to those people that your government is big time on the nose for breaking the law.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a famous book by an economist called Albert Hirschman. Don't know if you've heard of it, Exit, Voice, and Loyalty.
Yeah.
So he says that, you know, when you have a, you know, when citizens are dissatisfied about what's going on in their state, they have, I mean, two major options. So one of them is that they can leave, or the other one is that they can exercise their voice to change things. And the two are substitutes for one another. The easier it is to leave, the less incentive you have to use your voice and to change the policy. And so I think that actually preventing Russians from leaving Russia is kind of forcing them to say, look, you need to do something here. It's increasing the incentives for them to take action against against Putin. It's unfair on those people. You know, I don't take any joy in saying that. I'm not with those people who say, well, you know, the Russians didn't protest against the massacres and Bukham and so on, but now they are protesting against. Well, I mean, they are, you know, and that's how human nature is, right? It's not anything specific to Russia.
And also you've got to factor in what people know.
Yeah,
because information is not flowing freely inside Russia about this, and it hasn't been for most of the time this war's been going on. Which brings us back actually to the mobilization. I mean, the thing that I instantly thought at the moment that it got announced was, well, how do you still maintain this fiction that this is a special military operation
right.
when you're having to draw in 300,000+
Well, this is another problem for Russia in the war is that it's now impossible for them to try and pretend that they're winning. So research shows that public support for wars, and this is primarily in the American context, is driven by casualties and also by perceived chances of victory. So publics will generally tolerate casualties as long as they think that the chances of victory are high.
What about relevance as an issue?
Well, yeah, so that's kind of in the background. That's not something really that can be changed over the course of the war. So what they think, whether they think that the war is actually worth fighting or not, is something that they've already decided on at the beginning of the war. But as the prospects for success recede, support will go down. And I mean, albeit this is research in the American context, but I don't see it being too different in the Russian context. So many people, even those who thought that the war was justified in the beginning, can now see that it's going to hell in a handcart. And this is likely to make it more likely that they will switch from support for the war to opposition. It will also cause them to bring into question the competence of Putin's government too.
Yeah, so, well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because that relevance thing, though, is fascinating too, because obviously that's something that governments control to some extent in terms of the narrative they try and sell to their population at the beginning. And that might be different in a liberal democracy than it would be in an autocratic state where they, you know, simply dictate what the media can and cannot say and very, very closely police, you know, what public discourse there is about it. And that is, I suppose, the contrast. But if we think back to, you know, Vietnam, the US sold the idea that this was, you know, the domino theory that Russian or communist states are, you know, dropping like, or states are dropping to communism like dominoes. This has to be stopped here and so forth. If we think about Afghanistan, I mean, George and Laura Bush early on in the Afghanistan fight were saying this was about liberating Afghans, women and girls.
Yeah.
Look at where the women and girls are now in Afghanistan.
Yeah, right.
And they did a deal that excluded women in every stage when they did those negotiations with the Taliban, you know, all those years later and ended up with a situation that's just as bad or worse than it was before. So, you know, I mean, these are all terribly sad tales and we may be on the cusp of you know, yet more excruciating sadness out of Ukraine. Let's take a quick break there and come back and talk about that.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
All right, welcome back. You're listening, of course, to Democracy Sausage from the Australian National University. I'm Mark Kinney, and I'm talking to Dr. Charles Miller. And, Charlie, where do you see things going now in terms of this Ukraine war? Because there's a range of ways that we can all see, you know, there's the nuclear threat, there's the gains that have been made by Ukraine, there's the role of the West in all of that, there's the possibility that Putin now is cornered. You know, he's been described as the cornered bear by a number of people. What does he do? He's cornered, but he's also profoundly well-armed. We know the sort of Russian approach to warfare in the past, throw human bodies at it. We're worried that not only will he do that, but he could do a whole lot worse.
Yeah. Well, okay. So starting off with the mobilization. So putting 300,000 men in uniform and giving them a gun is not creating an army. It's creating a target, basically. If that's what the Russians do, then the Ukrainians will go through them like a hot knife through butter, and they will kill a vast number of them, but more likely just a vast number of them will surrender or desert.
And why do you say that? Is that because of the sort of argument that I've heard put, which sounds pretty convincing to me, that Ukrainians are fighting for their country and Russian soldiers are fighting because, you know, they're either for their salary or because they've been ordered to, which is a sort of a different motivation?
It's partly that. I mean, I think that those kind of what we call ideational motives are important in war. But when it comes right down to it, and you know, you're in a trench and the bullets are flying, it's quite tempting just to forget about these ideational things and just to concentrate on survival. So one thing that I've never served in the military in combat, but what I do know from talking to people who have is that when you are under fire, what they say is the training kicks in. So training instills in you a set of automatic reflexes which you will follow if the military's done its job properly, will allow you to function, right? To fight back, to fight in ways that will maximize your unit's chances of victory.
It's a really good definition of it, actually. I've never heard it put well, because it's like it replaces those, right, those faulty instincts that you might, an ordinary person might have, with some more strategic and purposeful actions that may see you survive.
That you don't even need to think about. I mean, like an interesting example of this is in the 18th century, so lots of soldiers would desert back in those days. And one of the ways that the authorities would be able to catch them out is because they could tell from the way they walked that they were former soldiers. So you see like a peasant walking in one way and a former soldier would walk because they trained, their instincts were so replaced by those of a soldier that they couldn't even conceal it, even when it was massively in their interest to do so. And so training is really, really important in these kind of situations. And the problem with not training soldiers properly is that instead of having these new instincts, what they have is the old instinct, which is just to run for cover, throw away your weapons, whatever. I mean, so, and this would be a problem even if the Russians, Russian soldiers believed in the cause they were fighting for, which I think overwhelmingly for a lot of these people is not anymore going to be the case. So that's why I think you would see this kind of like, you know, hot knife through butter type situation. You know, we saw in the Persian Gulf War in 1991 that, you know, that's what happened to large parts of the Iraqi army. You know, we saw
this was Desert Storm.
Exactly. We saw this in the Second World War in North Africa in 1914 with the Italians. You know, the Italians were attacked by a much smaller British, Australian, New Zealand, Indian force.
This is El Alamein, was it?
No, this is prior to El Alamein. This is before Rommel. Rommel was sent by Hitler to sort of stabilize the situation, because initially it was just the Italians versus the British Empire, and the small British Empire force was just going through the Italians like crazy, and they were just surrendering en masse. So this is the kind of situation that we would be talking about if the Russians send them in without proper training. If they give it some time, you know, 6 months, a year, they can quite possibly mold them into a reasonable fighting force. I mean, remember, the Russians did this in 1941 when they were attacked by the Nazis, and they had to mobilize a new army and train it and get it up to speed very quickly. But then, you know, you were dealing with, first of all, a direct threat against their homeland. You were dealing with a much more administratively capable, ruthless state. And you were also dealing with a much larger number of young men, both in absolute terms and as a proportion of the population. So the Russians probably won't be able to do that to the same degree. And it doesn't look like they're even trying. It looks like they're basically just giving them 2 weeks training and then sending them into the field. And that's a recipe for disaster. So that's the problem with the mobilization. If we talk now about the nuclear issue, because I do think this is incredibly important. So I see in the media and I see in the way that people are talking about this, a sort of lack of recognition of the seriousness of the situation. So, you know, you go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Well, I was going to mention the Cuban Missile Crisis. Before we even do that, though, just to this lack of recognition, is this just a failure of imagination? Like, as in, this hasn't happened? A bit like, the Queen died recently and even though she was 96, people were kind of, some people were genuinely sad and stuff, but there was this sort of sense of shock. And you're thinking, well, it's just that, you know, there was there becomes this kind of unthinkable nature of something that's been around for so long. There have never been nuclear weapons used in combat since the Second World War.
Right.
And so it just feels like, even if you think about the Cuban missile crisis, they still weren't used, right?
Well, I mean, that would presumably change if they actually were used.
Yeah, right? It would change quick smart.
Right, exactly. You know, right now, we're still talking about a lot of the same, like, nonsensical stuff that we've always been talking about, celebrities and, you know, various different sort of moral panics and things like that. But instead, we should be really taking this seriously. So the Good Judgment Project, so they are a group of kind of amateur forecasters who try and forecast world politics and world events. And generally they're pretty good. They're not always 100%.
Are these what you call super forecasters?
That's exactly the ones, the super forecasters. So I checked out what they thought the probability was of some kind of nuclear weapon being used in this war. They put it at 10%, so 1 in 10. Now, that obviously is vastly more unlikely than likely. But still, considering what we're talking about, 1 in 10 is pretty high.
Yeah, especially with the stakes of it, you know, are huge if it happens. Right. So.
Well, I mean, I tend to think that 1 in 10 figure, that's actually I don't want to kind of, you know, boast too much, but that's the figure that I had in the back of my head as well. 1 in 10. On the anti side, you know, the reason why Putin wouldn't do it, don't think it's got anything to do with morals. He doesn't have any. He cares about, the only human life he cares about is his own. I'm not even sure he cares that much about his kids' lives. But anyway, that's not a problem for him. The problem is, okay, on the strategic level, if he uses a strategic nuclear weapon. So by that, a strategic nuclear weapon, I mean something that's fired from a silo in Russia or a submarine that is a very, very big weapon that would wipe out an entire city, that kind of thing. This is really what we think about when we think about nuclear weapons as a strategic weapon. So if he does this, then we are in mutually assured destruction world, okay? You see, nukes New York or something, right? Then the United States nukes Moscow. That's the end of civilization. And more importantly,
the nukes get off before the initial ones even land.
Launch on warning, yep. So that I don't think he will do, because that is the end of him. That is the end of his life. That is the end of everything that he has worked for, everything he cares about. So I don't think he's likely to do that. When we are talking about nuclear weapons in this context, we're talking about tactical nuclear weapons. So a tactical nuclear weapon is something for use on the battlefield, not against a strategic target like an enemy capital. And it's designed for use against soldiers. It could be delivered by an artillery shell, it could be delivered by a bomber, or it could be delivered by a medium range rocket coming out of Russia itself. The size of the weapons would be varying from about 1 kiloton, which would be the equivalent of 1,000 tons of TNT, up to about 100 kilotons. And this would be bearing in mind that most of the tactical nuclear weapons the Russians have are on the smaller end of that scale. So there's a small number of very large tactical weapons and a much larger number of smaller tactical
weapons.
And
no one's ever used tactical nuclear weapons in battle before.
So
they've only ever been tested.
They've only ever been tested, right. So what would this mean? So there's a very interesting website if users want to, or listeners, sorry, want to go on it, called Nuke Map.
Hopefully they're not users.
right. No, not users of nuclear weapons, right? But what you can do, and I carry this exercise out for my students when I teach about nuclear weapons, because I think it's useful to really understand what we're actually talking about here. You can select, you know, what the size of the weapon is and so on, and then detonate it over various places and see how many people would die, how far the fallout would be and so on. If you took, like, say, a 50 kilo, so I did this the other day, take a 50 kiloton weapon and detonate it in the center of Canberra. So that'd be one of the larger Russian tactical nuclear weapons. Detonate it in the center of Canberra, you're looking at about 9,000 dead straight away, just with the blast, 15,000 wounded. And then you're looking at a fallout based on the prevailing winds, which would extend up to the outskirts of Sydney, past Goulburn, all the way up to Sydney. So that's what you're talking about. Now, if the Russians were to use one of these weapons against the Ukrainian army, however, I think the casualties and the fallout would be quite a lot less, for two reasons. First of all, the Ukrainian army is much more dispersed over the territory than the population of Canberra. The population of Canberra is tightly packed in the middle of the city. So that would mean that if you did that in Canberra, there'd be much more casualties. And second, a lot of the Ukrainian army will be in heavily armored vehicles. And surprisingly enough, heavily armored vehicles are actually pretty good protection against tactical nuclear weapons. So you wouldn't be looking at 8,000 casualties. You'd be looking at something on the level of half of that. So it would be
really bad.
But that's
just the blast, right?
That's just the blast.
The fallout.
Yeah, the fallout. So the fallout then would probably carry, again, based on the prevailing winds, it would carry back into Russia itself and certainly over Russian forces. Yeah. So it would kill quite a lot of their guys too. But again,
but the Russians have a tradition of killing their allies.
Yeah, they don't care about that. It's like the movie Braveheart, where King Edward is there and he says, you know, unleash the archers. And his one of his generals says, won't it hit our own men? He was like, well, yeah, I suppose it will, but it'll hit theirs too. And that's kind of, I think, the way that Putin would think about it. But, you know, so you'd be looking at, let's say, about 3,000, 4,000 casualties. So then the actual military effect of that would not be huge, considering the size of the Ukrainian military and the amount of losses that we're generally talking about. So it wouldn't be enough, just one of them by itself, to turn the tide of the war. It would be more for the shock value of having used nuclear weapons and the prospect of more to come. The aim would be then to get the Ukrainians to negotiate and get the Russians to keep what they've already got and get the West to stop providing the Ukrainians with supplies.
Now, this I've heard this described as a doctrine in Russian strategic thinking, defense thinking, which is escalate to de-escalate, which is you basically shock the other side with the sheer sort of purpose and ruthlessness of an act in order to sort of bring them to the negotiating table and have them make concessions.
Mm-hmm. So there's a really good explainer about Russian military doctrine on the War in the Rocks blog, and basically says that the Russians believe that you could actually have a nuclear war which is controlled, in the sense that each side would use just this little bit more nuclear weapons, gradually ramp up, rather than this immediate conflagration which would destroy the entire world. You would have some use of nuclear weapons, which the Russians would gradually ratchet up until the point where their adversary would basically give in and say, this is going too far, I'm going to give you what you want. That's basically
conundrum, though, isn't it? Because if we think about the fact, as we were just saying before, that none of these weapons have been used for 70 years more than 70 years since the Second World War, and they haven't been used because the sort of horror of their use has been enough to have the effect, right?
There's
once you start using them, then that gradual escalation process, you know, that becomes highly impossible to manage, right? I mean, if the West sees Putin using nuclear weapons, then it's no longer theoretical that he could go further.
Right.
It's kind of expected, right? It's a strategic likelihood.
Well, they have to think about this, right? And the problem is, like I say, there's no evidence because there's never been a mutual use of nuclear weapons in warfare before. So we don't have any evidence to go on this. We only really have speculation, which is why, you know, like it's a good idea to dust down a lot of these old Cold War tomes, these sort of Dr. Strangelove-esque tomes about nuclear deterrence and nuclear theory. You know, your Thomas Schellings, Hermann Kahn's, Bernard Brody's, and so on, and what they think would happen in the event of these nuclear escalations. The problem is for the United States. So say Russia has actually used a tactical nuclear weapon, okay, in the manner that we've just described. So what do they then do? So Michael Coffin, who's one of the top experts on Russian and Ukrainian military and military strategies, he was asked this question and he said, all I would say in that situation is good luck, Antony Blinken and the rest of the American nuclear security team, because I can't tell you what I would do in that situation. So he really doesn't know. On the one hand, you could go for a, if you like, a softer response, which would basically be, first of all, and this would probably go without saying, give the Ukrainians all of the help that they can get in terms of managing the fallout. So, you know, whether it be medical help, radiation suits, et cetera, et cetera. So that I would imagine they will obviously do.
Would any of that be happening already?
I mean, what's that, sorry?
Would any of that be provided already? I mean,
I don't know. I don't think so. I think we would know if they'd already provided it. But, you know, so that would be one obvious thing they could do. Then they could launch cyber attacks against the Russians. So again, thing is, we don't know about cyber attacks. The reason the Americans haven't done it yet could either be, first of all, that they're holding it in reserve and that there's some amazing cyber attack they can do that will really cripple the Russians, but they're holding it back for just this kind of purpose. Or maybe there just isn't anything there. There's nothing really serious that they can do to the Russians. We don't know. We can't know, because the minute we did know, then the Russians would find the vulnerability and patch it up. So that's another thing they can do. There's also the possibility of secondary sanctions. So what that means is basically you put sanctions not just on Russia, but also on any business from a third country that does business with Russia. So that would effectively force China to choose between the United States and Russia in terms of its economic links, and presumably you'd imagine they would choose the United States. If, of course, they didn't already put sanctions on Russia themselves for using tactical nuclear weapons. So, you know, those are all kind of possibilities that they could do. But considering that this would be an end to the nuclear taboo, this would be a breach of something that is in place in order to protect the human race from potential extinction, I don't know if that's enough. And so some of the possibilities being discussed by the United States and hinted at in briefings and so on include a conventional response against the Russians. This could mean, for example, one thing that's been talked about is that the Americans could launch some kind of a strike, whether it be an airstrike, cruise missile strike, against the Russian unit that carried out the tactical nuclear strike, destroy it. The model there would be 2017, when the US carried out similar strikes against units of the Syrian military that had used chemical weapons against insurgents. So that would be the idea. And the reason why you would destroy just that unit is to signal that that's the limit of American conventional involvement in the issue.
So that even under provocation, there is a sort of an entreaty, we take this action, but we're deliberately holding back.
We're holding back.
But of course, if the unit has launched from inside Russia, which presumably it would have, then the Russians are going to see an incoming missile
in their
systems. And of course, the whole mutually assured destruction deterrent system.
It could be. I don't know enough about the Russian system to be able to fully comment on that. I mean, presumably they would, they would have to suspect that it would probably be a conventional missile. But they wouldn't
suspect that. They would just see an incoming missile in a situation where they'd already used a tactical nuclear weapon, and they would assume, therefore, that their risk assessment would be this is an incoming nuclear weapon.
I can't say for sure. I don't know enough.
Neither can I. I mean, this is the problem we're in.
We don't know. So, I mean, in actual fact, in many ways, that would be quite a problematic response for the United States. Another thing that they could do is to launch airstrikes, cruise missile strikes against Russian forces in Ukraine itself. That might actually even be less escalatory. So what the idea would be to cancel out any kind of advantage that the Russians had gained through the use of the tactical nuclear weapon.
That would amount to effectively NATO saying, right, we're in this war now. You've pulled the nuclear trigger. We're in this war.
What they could say to the Russians is, okay, like, these are the units that we've destroyed. This is the reason, and now we're getting back out again. I mean, that's the theory anyway. So you could attack Russian the air defense system. You could attack the Russian Air Force, give command of the skies to Ukraine. But then, of course, that invites further Russian retaliation, right? So that's when we're starting to go up the escalation ladder. So that's why I think that there is this 10% outside chance that Putin would do it, because it would present a really difficult dilemma to Western policymakers then in terms of what they do.
Now, you have to go, and we have to go. So let me just ask you this final question. And again, this is sort of, obviously there's no firm answer that you can give to this, but interested in your thoughts on it. Putin's under some pressure inside Russia. I think that's clear from a range of different things and just from the performance in the war. This nuclear option, this nuclear saber rattling is intended to achieve something. He may feel like this is one of the other dynamics that sort of doesn't get talked about much, but he may feel like he's on limited time. That is, he has a closing window to achieve some decisive outcome. And that may also be a motivational factor here, in order to stop a coup happening inside Russia, for example, he pulls the nuclear trigger.
Possibly. But again, like I think that using a strategic weapon would be...
Well, I wasn't necessarily saying strategically.
Yeah, a tactical weapon, right. So this is something that is quite plausible. But that said, I've sketched out all of these scenarios here and they are quite troubling. But nonetheless, I think that Western governments need to stay the course with respect here. I'm not saying at all that we need to start scrambling around giving Vladimir Putin a reward for this. Because if he does, threatening to use nuclear weapons in this kind of situation in the context of an aggressive war, if he does this and gets away with it, is not a good precedent.
It's not a good precedent. But you mentioned before, or we both mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. The off-ramp for that, of course, was the US's decision, the NATO decision to pull missiles out of Turkey. The off-ramp here, people don't want to talk about this, and I understand why not, but the off-ramp here would be, and we see this plebiscite going on that's been going on in the Russian-held Donbass area. An off-ramp might be some sort of negotiated settlement in relation to where the border is drawn. Now, no one wants to talk about it, but if there's no off-ramp, there's a problem. How does the war end if there isn't one?
Look, I think that they need to, so the West really needs to think about the end state, what they're looking to do, and what they're looking to achieve. I don't think there's any question about that. But again, I'm really reluctant to say that this should involve any kind of territorial concessions over what is ultimately sovereign Ukrainian territory.
Of course, yeah. Because, I think that obviously is a starting point that everyone has in terms of a matter of law and the morals of it, the principle.
Mm, but, it could relate to something like NATO expansion, or there could be something that is which is in another dimension entirely. But still, being cognizant of the risks, I do think that if we allow Russia to gain from this any kind of territory, then, we're just storing up trouble for the future. We're saying to any potential aggressor that as long as you get, if you have nuclear weapons, you can threaten to use them, and then you can invade other countries, take their territory, and you'll get away with it. And if you don't have nuclear weapons, we'll get some, because then you can invade other countries.
That gives you that leverage. Yeah.
Right. We want other countries in the future to say, I don't want to end up like Vladimir Putin, not Vladimir Putin got away with it, so why can't I? Right. So I think that if we do concede in this situation, what we're likely to do, although we may save things for now, and we're just going to be dealing with the same kind of situation again in the future. So I think that the West should start thinking about, what the desired end state is and how they can bring this war to an end. I don't think that waiting for Putin to be overthrown is really a sound strategy, because there's no guarantee that's going to happen. So I do agree with that, but I think that it would have to involve some kind of off-ramp for Russia that does not mean that they get to keep more Ukrainian territory.
Yeah, it's a very difficult one, of course.
It's a winter, very difficult one, yeah.
Is coming as well. So
yeah, winter is coming. The war will not, I don't think the war will stop completely.
The Russians keep fighting through the winter.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, the Ukrainians do too. Yeah, exactly. It's not the Middle Ages. Like, you can still keep on fighting and supplying your troops through the winter. It's just that it's a little bit more difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Look, we could keep talking about this for so long, because there's so many dimensions of it, and we'll definitely have you back to continue this discussion.
Yeah.
And hopefully, we won't see any horrible negative developments occurring in the interim.
If there are, it looks like this is a fairly well sheltered place.
This studio we're in, that's right. It does. It's almost airless. Which, I don't think it's great for a whole range of other reasons, but it's designed for audio. Hopefully the audio is good. So, Charles Miller, thanks so much for being
You're
on
welcome,
Democracy Sausage Again, which, as I've said before, comes from the Australian National University each week. Really good to have you here, and we'll be back again next week. Until then, bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.